open the question and answer with a question of my own. And I, you know, Karen has, I guess, answered this to some degree, but I think we'd be happy to hear more from her. You know, I am absolutely jolted by the juxtaposition of your two presentations. I mean, from Clemens, we hear this story of the, you know, the persistent human engagement with this issue of human rights and its importance. Examples of really heroic struggling and wrestling with the issues of human rights, and then we run headlong into this story of distortion and complicity. And so, you know, my question is there isn't any reason for optimism about our ability to come to some collective will about the importance of human rights, especially in a context where international terrorism is on the minds of every government and every individual.
I'm an optimist in life, and this week I've come down here. I was invited by West Point Military Academy this week, and I gave 5 lectures there, partly to open a new law center, which was deeply moving, partly deeply shocking, what has actually happened. But what struck me among all the young undergraduates, I'm not sure if you call them undergraduates in West Point, was firstly the high intelligence, the incredibly good questions they asked, and the complete unanimity that torture, as we know it, and in Guantanamo Bay, is something horrific and must be stopped. I never imagined when I arrived from London, this beginning of this week, that everybody would be so shocked as I have always been about this. The only thing was, we had one meeting, I don't want to mention names here for various reasons, where a judge from Virginia spoke, because we were debating where do you try terrorists in the United States, in several new courts, should there be an international court for terrorists, and so on. And her view was that the American legal system is sufficient to try any terrorists on American territory, and America has sufficient legal agreements to enforce this and send the terrorists back to a country for imprisonment or leave them in the States. And she described to me how in her court, the terrorists who were charged sometimes used it as a platform for propaganda for themselves and went completely wild. What I didn't know, perhaps it's common knowledge here, that all your prisoners, when they go in a court with a jury, they are marched in a special way so the juries do not see that they are shackled. Secondly, she said, and I think Lorraine Bettler was there at the time, some of these terrorists who are very wild, they put a body belt on them, and they tell them that if they don't behave, they'll get an electric shock which will make them incontinent. And I was absolutely stunned that such a thing could happen in the United States. Now, whether this is only in Virginia or somewhere else, I don't know. But for me, that was horrific. But apart from this one judge, all the other people were incredibly sensitive that the law should be fair, equitable, where we do not have habeas corpus for people, that some new formula must be worked out. The view of the lawyers there, very eminent Supreme Court judges, was that there were sufficient ways of doing this within the United States, and it was not necessary to have an international court just for criminals. I am optimistic because we have people like Karen who highlight these problems. We have people in all your news agencies who are hungry for news, the most obscene news of any sort. I believe that public opinion, when it knows about something, is able to react. But if I look at the Geneva situation, Sir Nigel Rodney, the chairman of the anti-torture committee in the UN in Geneva, I don't know how he will react when he sees Karen's report. And I don't know how other people will react and whether there will be a very serious condemnation, and how the United States government will react when it's confronted with these problems. But I think fundamentally, everybody I saw in West Point was conscious that America has been deeply wounded by these matters and must come back onto an even keel. And if America is not the bastion of human rights in the world, there are very few other countries left who will be. And I think it would be a tragedy if not a real effort is made here. But even more important is what we do in the Council of Europe. We are on the Council of Europe. We look at the causes of intolerance, racial hatred, and we try not to use sticking plaster to stop something at the end, but to find that, to heal the wounds by all kinds of complex ways of bringing education into every aspect of life. We have now from our government, thousands of children in schools go to Auschwitz once, paid for by our government. We have similar schemes starting now in other countries. We have youth exchanges between all peoples and countries in the 47 countries. We have common things like ecology, where young people are brought together to realize what it means to have a good ecology. And I believe that to find common denominators where we all work together, maybe for your grandchildren, and certainly I hope for mine, a way forward that we have more tolerance and understanding. Like with your dance groups, when you bring people together in something where race and color don't matter, and they work together, then maybe this is the way forward for the next generation.
Karen, did you want to comment further?
I'm normally a very optimistic person. I just want to say that. This is a tough week. But next, so I'm not. I think we're digging our way out of it as best we could. I think these moves by the this administration have been terrific. I think the issue of the conversation between the United States and the rest of the world, whether it's the European, whoever, is never been an easy conversation. We consider ourselves a country of exceptionalism. I would say if nothing else has ended that idea, maybe it's the practice of torture, because now we're just like everybody else. But I think the optimism here is going to have to be because we're self-correcting, which has always been, you know, an important political as well as legal concept here. That's my optimism, is that we'll be self-correcting in a way that's lasting.
Yes. Either one of you, then the other.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that I'm concerned about is, of course, the struggle in China. When you see Hillary Clinton arriving in China, and there's no more a dialogue about human rights in light of our economic crisis, don't you think we're going in the wrong direction due to the recent financial pressures in the United States?
Did everyone hear that question? It had to do with the failure of the Obama administration to raise issues of human rights in the discussion, in recent discussions with China.
That's what I meant when I said we're not going back to square one. Somehow the bar got moved, and that is a perfect example. It's luxury. And there are other things just more important, and apparently, I think it's a huge problem. It's not just giving up the moral leadership. It's the idea that something in our brains has changed, and I don't think it's just fear. I think the economic collapse has has sort of swamped everything else. And because human rights was already under attack, we're now going to see some pushback. And China, I mean, we hadn't even gotten to push forward with China, and now we're getting pushed back, so it's a little frightening. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yes.
I'd just like to follow up on Germaine's point about optimism and pessimism, and specifically to you, Karen, about I've read the reports in the New York Times from the Justice Department on Thursday, and
can you speak a little louder? I'm afraid that some people can't.
I can just repeat it when you're done, if that's easier.
This is a very painful moment. I think we all owe Lorraine Beitler a great deal of thanks that in this exact moment, we're having this conversation right here, right now. And what is very disturbing is that in the past, there used to be something called investigative journalism. And there was a belief since the Enlightenment that when you make things known, things can change. And we have watched for the last 8 years horrible things take place, and we've known about them. We've had photographs of them. We've had documents and reports and investigative journalism, and yet we no longer seem to be affected by those things. And so the cause for pessimism that I have is different than the pessimism after the 2004 election, when I could understand the trauma of 9/11. My concern and my question when it comes to optimism and pessimism has to do with the belief that through education, through the work of collections, of libraries and educators, that we can make a difference. I think that's what's at stake in this debate, and that's what causes me such so unsettling about what you said.
You know, I'm really happy you said that. I just want to give you a little glimpse of my life. Like, my real life is I run a center called the Center on Law and Security. And we issue reports and we collect documents. We do a lot of interesting things. But what we actually do is we have somewhere between 70 and 100 public events a year on a variety of topics that have to do with national security and all this stuff. And so whenever I go to funders, they're like, well, what's my deliverable going to be? And I'm sort of like, well, we were thinking that educating the public would be a good deliverable. And it's always like, no, I'm sorry. And so we always have to do something extra. But I think the point is that public education on issues of political and social relevance is not particularly valued. So you're right in thanking Lorraine Beitler and just in issuing a cautionary note. But I think there's going to be a lot of things to debate going forward, so stay tuned until you're ready.
Yes.
Yes. In hearing this, I couldn't help thinking about how the Nazis got the power, the complicity, and the control of the professionals. But a driving force in history, when you have reduction in human rights, is fear. And clearly, the United States public has been in fear since 9/11. And so the question is, in dealing with the immediate situation involving the torture, isn't it true that torture has no particular effect in terms of alleviating and getting information that is useful, and that particular fact has been recognized from Miranda and before? And so, isn't it true that in terms of education, that is one of the prime goals is to educate the public to that fact? So that, because I was watching CNN a couple nights ago when this first came out, and Anderson, whatever his name is, was very, the first question he made sure that was addressed was, isn't it true that, we haven't had an attack since 9/11, and that this particular policy may have been a prime reason for that? I mean, isn't that kind of what we need to educate the public about?
Yeah. I was one of those I want to say, don't get me started, but the misinformation has been given to the American public has been intentional and somewhat problematic. The answer to why haven't we had another attack, is it because torture has kept us safer? In my estimation, is the attack itself was unforgivable, and that was the fluke, not the not having attack afterwards. We got very unlucky. unlucky, and we were very unprofessional about what we were doing when that came about, both in terms of our agency, our intelligence services, and our interagency process. Having said that, torture can work. You just don't know what it means for it to work. So let me give you an example. We were told this recently. We brought in a former Army interrogator who talked about not using enhanced interrogation techniques. But he had spent a lot of time in Iraq, and he talked about the way in which you could get information from somebody. They tell you where the safe house is. You go to the safe house, and 5 times out of 10 or more, the American soldiers would be killed. In other words, what he would have said is, you know, you can torture somebody and get information, and it might be right. So they could tell you where the safe house is, but they're not going to tell you if it's booby-trapped. So the quality of the information you get, right, or, you know, if they tortured me, they're going to get whatever they want. If they torture somebody who's, you know, who's not involved in the battle, maybe. Torture can work, and I don't think it should hinge on that premise of whether it can work or not. It should hinge on the fact that you get better information in two ways. One, by establishing some kind of rapport, even though it's a dominant, you know, a captive relationship. And the thing about torture that I think is the most destructive for national security is that when you know that torture's in your bag of tricks, you don't do what you need to do ahead of time on the ground. And this is what caused 9/11. And if the next attack's in 10 years or 20 years, it doesn't really matter. You need to have an intelligence agency, a law enforcement apparatus, a military, and a diplomatic corps that are working together and not thinking, we're going to torture them at the last minute. Because in every time you hear these torture scenarios, it's about, even in these memos themselves, it should be a last, if there's a last minute situation. What last minute situation? Are you kidding? These things are planned, the kinds of things you saw in 9/11, for years. And so it is a tremendous distraction from really finding out what threatens us. In terms of why we haven't had another 9/11, if you talk to people who work in the national security establishment, they will tell you a variety of answers. And the first one they'll say is the invasion of Afghanistan. That the invasion of Afghanistan and its attack on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban was devastating and powerful, and that it has built itself back up in a variety of forms over the years, and that we once again are concerned about a number of threats, which may or may not be directed at the U.S. mainland. Nevertheless, that they've been able to rebuild something. That would be one thing. Another thing is more vigilance. Another thing is not letting down our guard and becoming complacent the way we did. But I would not venture that torture is what's done it. And they have had 8 years to prove to us exactly what they've learned from torture. And all they ever say is state secrets, national security. The head of the counterterrorism effort the former head of the counterterrorism effort in Scotland Yard was in New York this week. And he said, you know, that's really interesting about what is it that we're going to present in court, or we're going to present to the public, that we're going to tell them what, that we wiretap them? We know they wiretap them. We're going to tell them how we get their cell phones? They know how we get their cell phones. And he went through a whole list of them. I mean, I think it's not just about fear. You're right, it's about a insufficient leadership in a way that is appalling. And I'm glad I'm not president, because that is a huge task that confronts this administration. But it's doable. It's doable, and it's probably doable rather quickly. But one of the things that they have to be able to do is to say, 9/11 should not have happened. And until we're willing to accept some of our mistakes, when you're reading these torture things, these torture memos that just come out, it comes out, we can't admit to our own incompetence or dropping the ball on something. And so we construct these incredible scenarios. We made a mistake, and we made a lot of them since. And that's probably the starting point.
Could I just make one comment? I believe education, I believe America is one of the most skilled countries in propaganda, in advertising. It has failed completely with all those skills which have made McDonald's popular with children from Tokyo to Vladivostok, has got Coca-Cola up the Amazon River, and people know America from these things in a way which is very positive. Why have you never been able to achieve a propaganda war against people in countries like Saudi Arabia, where our friend Bin Laden comes from, to highlight that this is a whole rubbish, that we are an evil, wicked society, when their own society is dictatorial, corrupt, has no freedom for women. Imagine in Walmart, somebody buys a packet of cornflakes and is arrested and his arm is chopped off. It's just unthinkable. Now, none of this information has penetrated into those countries who should themselves condemn the fanatics like Bin Laden and his henchmen. And I find that quite incredible, because many years ago, I was involved in helping Jews getting out of Russia in 1970. I was with René Cassin at the Human Rights Commission already, and I spoke on Liberty Radio about letting Jews out and how ridiculous for communists it was not to let people have freedom of thought. And much to my amazement, within a year we had 30,000 Jews immigrating to Israel, and I met some of the Jews who got out of Georgia, because I was on Golda Meir's planning commission, and they wanted to meet me because they had heard Liberty Radio and my voice in Georgia, and they said that gave them hope that there was a future, and they then left. And of course they kissed me and they cried. It was very moving. But America has those skills, but somehow they don't seem to get into the right areas. At West Point they're now teaching Arab languages, they're teaching few languages, but it's taken a very long time. How few people there know about Islamic traditions and about the Quran. We certainly have our problems in England, but at Cambridge University I was chairman for 8 years for a college where we have Islamic, Jewish and Christian studies, where we invite imams and clergymen and rabbis to sit together, not to say one is better than the other, but to look at the common interests of the philosophy of religion. And it's enormously successful. We put a Russian monk together with an Orthodox rabbi from Israel. The two quarreled for 6 months every day. But when they left, they hugged each other. They were friends. We have to find ways to communicate with the young people in those countries.
Yes, sir.
Being pessimistic or optimistic is really not the issue. I can't. How does one take human rights and its evolution and progress? How does one take human rights and its evolution and progress, the historical survey that you presented, overly seriously when we look at a contemporary world in which huge chunks of the world's population really don't believe in it? We can talk about the clashes of civilizations of all kinds, and it's when you take 1 billion Chinese who really are not in a position to speak about their own human rights, when you take 1 billion Muslims whose concept of Sharia over dominates any notion of human rights, one can even talk about the Roman Catholic Church and its own insistence on its own definition of what human rights are. And then there are all the petty potentates around the world who are prepared to use the concept. I mean, this Durban conference of several years ago is now about to be replicated in Geneva. So the question of how could you be optimistic about education and diplomacy and policies is a source of deep concern to me.
What are the alternatives? The alternatives, you give up, you see no hope whatsoever for the future. Everything becomes like a Bush administration. Europe stops debating problems on human rights. In China, the progress which has been made in the last 10 years is unbelievable. Unbelievable how their economy has grown, how many new developments there are, the people have enough to eat at the moment. They didn't have enough to eat before. There are, of course, in China with 1.3 billion, it's still tiny compared to what it needs to be. But there is a movement in that direction. The fact is that people in the different provinces, the heads of state, discuss human rights. Have been unthinkable under Mao Zedong. And there is a feeling, look at India, which has nearly the same population as China. There are great pockets, or the majority of Indian people, do live in some form of human rights. It's a remarkable democracy, considering what it could have been. Of course, there are the caste systems working, which are not exactly, which are hopeless, but still there is a movement towards more democracy, more freedom of expression. And I think one has to not imagine it can happen very quickly. I know for 2,000 years, it's about time that things moved. But I believe the United Nations is a wonderful platform where people can meet. The Durban Conference, we were at the Durban Conference, the last one, and it was traumatic in its horror from a Jewish point of view. But there were other things discussed as well. It wasn't all anti-Israel. There were many other subjects not related to Israel which were discussed, which were important. We presented a whole group of papers on racism on the internet. How do we handle racism on the internet? How do we monitor this? How do we have cyber space control over racial incitement to racial hatred? And there are other things which are happening which do move slowly forward. They can't always be promoted too much in public to begin with. And I think the fact that there is a protest about Durban 2 on an enormous scale and that everyone is alerted is important. What is catastrophic is that in the UN there are still the Arab blocs with the African bloc have the majority. So really sensible decisions on matters of interest to the world are blocked if that bloc wants to damage something. There's nothing can be done about it. But now we are much more optimistic, seeing a trend that Sharia, Shiites, have become so militant that the Sunni are starting to become frightened. And the Watanabe in Saudi Arabia are also frightened. And one can see that there could be more tensions to break up this monolithic situation in the UN, and that some of those countries will have to rejig their whole concepts. But it's very difficult, especially with Iran at the moment, which is a catastrophe.
Lady back here.
Thank you. I would like to ask you about President Obama's recent statement that he still upholds private presidential statements and will not reveal them. And I'd like to know where Eric Holder stands on some of these issues.
I'd like to know the same about Eric Holder, but I'm assuming that that he and the president are on the same page. In terms of the state secrets privilege, I don't quite understand where this is all headed, but what the president has done is in two instances said, I uphold what the Bush administration said in these regards, that we cannot reveal certain things, let's say in the case of a case in courts out on the West Coast, because it will reveal things about national security that we don't want it to reveal. What many of us suspect is that what he doesn't want to reveal is these are cases involving the CIA, that what he may not want to reveal are things that the CIA did. Let me try to spin this the other way, not that I agree with this. He's presented with the problem that he needs an intelligence agency to make the country safe. If you're going to fight national security on the levels that are necessary, you need good intelligence. It's what we didn't have the right way in 9/11. So he's got this on the one hand, which he may or may not have understood in all of its complexity, and my guess is didn't, before he became president. And then you have, on the other hand, the fact that the CIA's complicity in the torture really does come down to the CIA. This is not about the military, which, you know, may or may not, how it may have appeared to the American public. That if he's going to destroy the agency at the same time that he needs the agency, this is what he's balancing. I'm assuming he's balancing. And I think Eric Holder is trying to get him to balance it. Look, our understanding is that the debate over releasing these documents inside the executive, and in particular Department of Holder's Department of Justice, was brutal. I mean, there were some people that wanted to claim an equivalent to the state secrets privilege for this to come out. So I guess what we have to do is say, look, we're grateful for this. There are more. There's more to come. We don't know if we're going to get them, but there's more to come. They won this battle. I thought the question you were going to ask is, what about Obama's statement when he released these documents that the agency not only should not be prosecuted, but we're going to pay for the process, for the, you know, we're going to use our tax dollars to pay for their defense. After you read the memos, it's clear that it's a conversation. It wasn't the Department of Justice saying, go do this. It was the CIA saying, they work together. But he hasn't quite mastered all of the complexities of the national security conversation yet, and it's not easy. And that's my best attempt to be what's fair.
Would you pardon Rumsfeld?
Would I pardon him? I mean, is someone going to make him guilty?
No. Is he going to pardon Rumsfeld? And supposing a Spanish court comes out and condemns and wants to take Rumsfeld to trial, what happens then? What will Obama's position be? That's my question.
Obama administration sent officials to meet with the Spanish government this week. They convinced the Spanish government that it would be a not good thing to let these charges be leveled. I don't know that the Spanish government has control over the Spanish investigating magistrates. That, I mean, seriously, people don't know whether that is. If they exercise the right of universal jurisdiction and issue indictments against Rumsfeld or Cheney or Addington or you or, you know, there's six people they've mentioned and they're all lawyers, I think. So they're not even Rumsfeld yet. If they do that, then they're not going to be able to travel. If I were them, I wouldn't travel. I mean, they're not going to be able to travel. What more? And if they do travel, they can be apprehended. Obama has said from at least the first day of his presidency, if not before, you know, that he does not have the stomach for prosecution. However, that's what he said. But if I didn't have the stomach for prosecution, the last thing I would have done was release these documents. So, who knows? You know, there are other ways to take care of people than the government having to go out and prosecute people. And then I'm happy for them to pay for their defense. You know, so. So who really knows? And I think that's why I mentioned the issue of letting the documents out ahead of the executive orders themselves, because it's a slam dunk when you read them, and it doesn't matter who you are. So, no, I would not pardon Donald Rumsfeld.
We are past our time, and we're going to give the last comment to Clemens Nathan. I hope you'll stay around and continue these discussions. Maybe one of these years we'll figure out how to get to this level of discourse earlier in the process. But I'm going to give the last comments to Clemens Nathan, and I hope you'll join us for the reception outside and continue the talk that's become so stimulating.
There are two things I want to say. Firstly, in London, we had a conference 2 weeks ago about after the fall of Berlin Wall, the democracy and human rights. And the delegation from Russia was there. I was saying how over 300 Russian journalists have been murdered in the last 2 years, and in the last year, 50. And the journalists, they don't find journalists anymore. They find the public, not only in Russia, but in the German Democratic Republic, which is now the Federal Republic, people have lost the hope they had when the wall came down. And the one channel in Russia, for example, which dealt with serious problems, is now only a football channel. And nobody seems interested, except perhaps 300,000 or 400,000 people in the whole of Russia, in what's happening politically. it's very important to have a proper communication television dealing with these problems. I think that's one thing I wanted to highlight. And when Davos took place a month ago, the head of the Financial Times told us he spoke to Putin. What has happened to the 300 journalists? Who killed them? We want to know, in front of all the journalists from the whole world who were there. And Putin just didn't even answer properly. It shows that what I'm trying to show you is, don't be too pessimistic. You are good Americans. There is something positive in discussing here. You have a good press. The world is pretty grim roundabout. But altogether, we can achieve something. And I want to finish, if I may, nothing to do with today, but a lovely story about China. Long time ago, in one province in China, there was a terrible war between the different tribes, or whatever you like to call them. And they all belonged to one Buddhist monastery. And the monastery discussed the problem and invited the two worst haters of each other to the monastery for a weekend to meet each other. And amazingly enough, they came. And when they came into the refectory, they couldn't believe their eyes. The food on the table was something they had never seen. The wine, everything was beautiful. And when they sat down for dinner, they put on one side of the long table one group who were hating the ones on the opposite side. And then the chief of the monastery said, please start eating. When they took their chopsticks, they found they were so long, they couldn't eat with them. And then suddenly they cottoned on that if they fed the man opposite, they could eat. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Just two brief words before we move next door to the reception. First of all, I'd like to express our tremendous debt of gratitude to our two wonderful speakers this afternoon for their stimulating, enlightening, and challenging comments. I'd also like to thank Jermaine for being, as always, a wonderful moderator. I'd like to thank you all for coming out on a lovely Sunday afternoon and being present, and also for your penetrating and interesting questions, which provoked an all-too-short discussion. A couple of other people I need to thank also. We owe a tremendous debt to Marge Duncan here, who has worked tirelessly on this event. And as always, she works behind the scenes. She doesn't, you know, but she's there, and she really helps put the thing in place. And she's just an amazing force on this committee, and we owe her a tremendous amount. I'd also like to thank Carton Rogers, the Director of Libraries, and his staff, Tina Cowan, David McKnight, John Pollock, and Lynn Farrington, for all the work that they did to make this possible. And now I would like to invite you to come next door and also to join the book signing and talking with our guests. Thank you very much.